Well, I get a lot of questions when people say, well, you know, the Native Americans, they should get over it, you know, they should move on. But what they don't realize is that there's a lot of things that are still ongoing today. They don't think that Native Americans can adequately manage their money. And so the money that was coming into the individuals that were leasing their land was a fraction of what they were supposed to get. So this Cobell settlement is just an example of how the government is set up to take money that Native Americans get.
Forward,
They
you
would
mean?
go in for procedures like tonsillectomies and come out with a hysterectomy. They would go in for, have their appendix removed, and they would come out and have had their tubes tied. And this was all without their consent. The families that were implanted didn't realize that the implant was directly connected to their bank accounts.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today I wanted to focus on the Native American history and where they've gotten to where they are today. There's so much information there that our history isn't accurate. And there's a lot of things that we've been taught over the years that just isn't true. For example, people thought that the Native Americans were not part of the slave trade. But they actually were. And our guest today is going to share with us not only that, but other things about the Native American community that is actually fresher, like in the last decade, about the Native Americans being used as when there's social initiatives by our government, they will use the Native community, the Native American community, to test it out. For example, they're being chipped and they're being implanted, and what that is all about, and how that's affecting the Native American community, and how that really shows what the future could be like if Americans in general were chipped. Of course, there's some good parts to it and some easy stuff that can help us, but then there's this huge dark side to being chipped, and this exposes what some of the dark side can be, which is very enlightening. And she can't speak to everything that I would like her to talk about. And so, if there is any whistleblower that is out there that can talk about what happens on some of the Native American lands, I would really, really appreciate talking to you, because I know from other people that I've talked to that in the Native American lands, they're technically a sovereign nation. So the United States uses those lands to do a lot of things that people aren't aware of. And so what we need are whistleblowers that are willing to come out to talk about what is going on some of those lands. But Lena has a vast experience in government, UN, Washington, D.C., and she's going to talk about a lot of things that people aren't aware of. And so I'm really thankful that she's going to be coming on to the program and talking about this. But before we get into that, I want to first do a big shout out to Saeed Huber, who's one of my patrons. Thank you so much for supporting the program. I really appreciate you and all of my patrons. You guys are all really helping me cover the costs of the show and to maybe provide a little bit of incentive for me to keep going. And I also want to tell you that Lena sticks around and does another interview question for patrons only. I have a lot of content up there, including my two books and quite a bit of interview questions that are exclusive to patrons. So if you want to go there, support the program, I would really appreciate it. So let's now get into my interview with Lena Gilliland. Hi, Lena. Welcome to the program.
Hey Sarah, how are you?
I'm great. I'm really glad that you're joining the program because you have incredible insight onto the Native American journey in our country and what's happened, not just our country, but the whole North American continent. First of all, before we get into that, can you explain or tell our audience what your background is?
Yes, I know that I look white, but I'm not white. I'm Native American, on both my mother and my father's side, and I'm also part Scottish. I've worked in national and international sectors with Indigenous people all over the world and with tribes here for more than 20 years. I have my own company. I have my own marketing consulting company, so I try to bring tribal business together in a way that is a little different than it used to be. And I've created economic sustainability programs for different countries, as well as worked on human rights issues for everybody, not just women and children, but everybody in total. And so that's a rough draft of my background.
Well, you've been involved a lot with Washington, D.C. and the politics of the situation. And one of the big things is the money that the government has essentially taken from the Native Americans. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, how much was it? What happened? And, you know, the background on that.
Well, I don't really think that you can quantify it. The amount has been so vast that of everything that's been taken, land, you know, culture, money. Now, the Department of the Interior, we just won a Cobell, what was called the Cobell settlement. It was the largest in the history against the Department of the Interior. It was for $3.4 billion. And how that worked was it was a 15-year suit. And the government has what's called IMM accounts, which are managed money accounts by the Department of Interior. They don't think that Native Americans can adequately manage their money. So what happens is they have an oil and gas lease. The money from that lease goes into the individual's IMM account. Well, the Department of Interior had been siphoning money out of that account for years and years. And so the money that was coming into the individuals that were leasing their land was a fraction of what they were supposed to get. So this Cobell settlement is just an example of how the government is set up to take money that Native Americans get. And the travesty about the Cobell settlement is that they went through and they had all of these Native Americans to identify, but they said they weren't able to find them. Now, I know for a fact that they could find them because I looked at the list personally, and I knew almost everyone they were saying they couldn't find in the state of Oklahoma. The money that was not distributed back to the Native Americans went back to the Department of Interior.
So if those people would have contacted them, could they have gotten it, or was it a big game anyway?
I actually look at it as a big game because I actually did go forward and I actually said, I know where these individuals are. I pass these individuals every single day, as a matter of fact. They're tribal members, fellow tribal members. I pass them all the time. And they never did a thing about it. And it was up to the lawyers to contact the individuals. And I actually offered my services to, you know, extend and say, look, I can contact all these people. I actually know where they live. They didn't contact them.
Now the money's going back to them, and can they still get their money, or is it gone now? They claim it wasn't claimed, so
it has to be claimed within a certain time period. If it's not claimed within that time period, then it's forfeited. It goes back to the Department of Interior. Out of that $3.4 billion, $60 million was set up for a Native American scholarship fund for education. But any money that goes unclaimed outside of that goes back to the Department of Interior. And people that were involved in Cobell, that were astute in it, knew this, but a lot of people didn't know that. And a lot of people weren't aware that they were actually entitled to money. So
that's too bad. They never got their money. So there's other things as well that I've heard about, like forced sterilization, and it just ended not too long ago. Can you explain that program so people understand what our government did and how long it actually went on?
Well, I get a lot of questions when people say, well, you know, the Native Americans, they should get over it. You know, they should move on. But what they don't realize is that there's a lot of things that are still ongoing today. And IHS was created in 1955, and it was created for, quote unquote, the betterment of the Native American in their health. Well, the government decided that Native American families were having too many children. And so they actually issued through IHS the permission to force sterilize Native American women and Native American men. And in the 1970s, the Native American women began to come forward. They would go in for procedures like tonsillectomies, and come out with a hysterectomy. They would go in for, have their appendix removed, and they would come out and have had their tubes tied. And this was all without their consent. And so people began to come forward in the 70s, and the even though the government in 1974 passed an act helping protect Native American women, it was ignored. And so the sterilization went into the mid and end of the 1970s. And in some cases, during the 60s, what they did is they actually threatened the women. They said, if you don't follow through with the procedure, we're going to take your children. And we also aren't going to, they would withhold services of any type to Native American women and men during the 60s if they didn't follow through with the sterilization. It's estimated that between 1960s and 1970s, upwards of 50% of Native American women were sterilized without their consent.
Wow, and people don't know that. What caused that program to stop?
Women began to speak out. Women began to say, wait a minute, I went in and I came out and now I no longer have a uterus. Now I no longer have this. And people began to talk and they began to, actively try and stop it and go before congressional committees and the UN, different organizations like that. And finally, there was enough of an outcry that it did stop, but not until after the damage has already been done.
Well, yeah, imagine not being able to have children and all of a sudden. So were there other medical programs that they did on the American Indians that we are unaware of?
Well, another one, microchipping is huge. It's been huge for a while. And what a lot of people don't realize in the United States is that the chip was officially introduced in 2000 by Verichip. And in 2004, it was approved by the FDA for human usage. Well, they did the preliminary study in the interior of Alaska, where they knew that it was safe to do it because it was remote and it was hard. They did it under what they called the health data chip. And I don't know if you know now, but we've switched over to all electronic health records. And I have experience. I've worked in IHS for several years. And the chip, when the chip first came out, one of the people that helped design it actually wanted to use it on 17,000 children in the state of Florida that were considered orphans. Well, when it finally got FDA approval, they reassessed their demographic and they said, well, we think that Native Americans in this section of our country would be the better ones to do that. Well, when they went in, I actually have a copy of the feasibility study that they did on this. And they knew it was going to be difficult because if the elders don't accept it, it's not accepted in the community. And what they discovered was, there was a lot of youth that was coming into the cities. And this study was done by the University of Fairbanks. Their science and engineering management program put this together. And they were coming into the city to get jobs to help their families and their children. So when they went in, they paired with IHS, and what they said was, we believe this is the best way to keep track of all the health records. And, there's so many Native Americans that are traveling to different locations that this will make it real easy geographically to keep a hold of their health, and they don't have to orally tell it to us because they probably won't get it correct.
What's wrong with doing a database that shares information and all you do is pull up your name?
Well,
you can get that anywhere, but anyways, keep going.
You would think that that would be true, but when they started the feasibility study, it wasn't accepted very well in the Native community. So what their whole thing behind it was is that they wanted to be able, it's the size of a grain of rice. And I know people that personally have this chip. So this isn't coming second or third hand. They wanted to put it in the population that had mental disabilities or physical disabilities or Alzheimer's. So they went to a Native center that was set up for developmentally disabled individuals. Now, the key, the crux to this is, and this is what I was told directly, the families that were implanted didn't realize that the implant was directly connected to their bank accounts. So when they, to use the chip, just to use it, the average range is between $20 and $80 a year annually. So
who
you
pays
are charged,
for that?
You do. That's your cost. You're charged for that. And my one friend told me his daughter had Down syndrome. Now his whole family was implanted with this chip. When he went in, it immediately reads your bank account. It's a 16, unique 16-digit number. And his daughter's is in his in the shoulder, his is in his wrist. And if your bank account shows that you don't have enough money, you don't get service. So if you can't, if you go in and you can't make your copay, or you don't have insurance, for example, and you can't pay, then they turn you away. So when they scan it, not only do they have access to your health records, they have access to every piece of information that you have. And they have direct access. And like he said, they immediately, right then and there, take the money out of the account. There's no waiting. There's no negotiation. There's no anything. So if
so
you want
to... So if you don't agree, you're hosed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happens if you want it removed?
Well, see, that's something that we haven't come to yet. Nobody.
Well,
has
I would think they would want it removed.
Well, you would think so, except that they also, in the cases with the people that have Alzheimer's and disability, they have a way to interject medication through that chip.
How do they do that?
You know, I'm not sure about the technology. I know it's called, I believe it's called MediChip, and it's still made by Verichip, and it's a you know, a section of their division, and that's one of their selling points. Because they were having a really difficult time with the Native community. And so one of their selling points is, well, you know, if you have a daughter that's disabled, that has this or this, that, you know, could be difficult to give a regular shot to, the medication could actually be put in through the chip. And they've made it wireless now. So the chip can be controlled from any place that you have a computer or an internet connection.
See, you know, the whole thing about chips is there's always some good part to it. You know, if you have a disabled or if you have some medical need, that really makes sense. The problem is now they're crossing a line and going into your bank accounts and all sorts of stuff. They immediately, now that would be something my husband would go ballistic over. They immediately delete the money out of your account without you being able to argue that the transaction and what they did provided you with the proper services.
Right.
Talk about a nightmare situation.
Yeah. I don't want anyone in my bank account. You know?
No.
And I can tell you that I've disputed bills that have been wrong. And, you know, and so if you don't have the ability to dispute, you know.
Yeah. This is an example of a technocracy nightmare in action. I mean, this is what we're talking about when we're talking about technocracy. Go ahead.
Here's the thing is that they actually admitted that this would have severe social as well as legal and ethical ramifications, but they still did it.
The ethical ramifications, they have no excuse over. None whatsoever. They should live up to, they were voted into office or whatever they are. They took that's what they said to the American people or to the people they're dealing with, that we will operate it at high ethical standards, and they just don't.
No, they actually, by 2007, they had already done a study with Alzheimer's patients in a nursing home in New Jersey. They did 2,000 patients, and they implanted not only the Alzheimer's patient, but the caregiver.
Why the caregiver?
Because the caregiver, well... That depends on what you want to believe, but What they say is because the caregiver gives the medication, the caregiver takes care of it, takes care of the person. And I've been around quite a few Alzheimer's patients, and you know, I know they can be difficult. I know as the illness progresses, things are worse. And so they wanted to track the caregiver and what they did and the Alzheimer's patient. And they said it was so successful that they wanted to start implanting by the year 2007 all of the Alzheimer's patients that were within that area.
So did they end up doing that?
I haven't followed up on it, but I know that that was one thing that was posted in the Sun Sentinel and out of Florida. And so I would believe that probably yeah, because the company, in order to make it a success, what they decided to do was send the scanners out for nothing. And they sent scanners out to hospitals, to nursing homes, you know, different things like this. Another example is Presbyterian Hospital. Presbyterian Hospital had Verichip. They went under several different things. One was infant abduction. And so every baby that is born in the Presbyterian Hospital is given what's called a Hugs bracelet, and it's either on their foot, their ankle, or their wrist. And what it does is it tracks all the movement of the baby everywhere within the hospital. And so you can't take that baby anywhere. And how they touted it was there was a baby that was implanted with this infant abduction chip. And in July of 2005, the infant was located because of the chip.
Well, see, some of that is what I'm saying makes sense. I think the orphans, like they were going to do orphans initially, the kids
Yeah.
that are at high risk of being trafficked, which are orphans, kids in the child welfare system, those kind of
Yeah.
kids, if there is a way that they could have something on them, I don't know if I like anything implanted, but if there's a way that they could have something on them that we could constantly track and that these kids would be protected, I could see that. But at a certain point, once they become an adult, or once you become a free, you have to be free, you know? But we know that that population is at severe risk of trafficking. So, you know, there are some populations that I think it would be a helpful thing, but to tie to your bank account and to be able
Well,
to get all
see,
that stuff is out of control.
and the problem is that they claim the chip can outlive the life of the user. So if you're implanted as an infant, you know, like you said, once you reach an adult age, you really don't have, by then you're so used to the implant because, like I said, it's so small, but you've never had a say. And so by the time you go and open a bank account, you know, when you start working, when you're 15, 16, you're already tied into the system.
Oh,
You're
that's
not
just
on the books.
terrible. I could see that happening. Now, do you know, has there been an outcry in the Native American community back pushing back against this?
They've been really selective on which communities. They've chosen the ones that specifically are in the outlying areas. And like I said, the interior of Alaska is the size of the state of Texas. And so in my community here, a lot of people are shocked. A lot of the Native Americans are like, no, we don't want anything in us. You know, we've had it with the government. We don't trust the government. And so they don't want this. But like I said, there's been, you know, a portion of the population where they said, you know, we've got to have this information. And they started with the ones that the families that had children with disabilities.
One thing that you mentioned is that the government constantly doesn't trust American or the Native Americans to manage their own money and to manage themselves. Has that attitude changed, or do they still think that way and they still walk in with this attitude that we're gonna plan for you and can help you out?
Oh no, they still have that attitude. That's why we have IIM accounts, and IIM accounts are managed by the Department of Interior, and then the checks are sent through the Department of Interior to Native Americans, and our IHS system is managed by the Department of Defense. So all Indian health centers that are government facilities are managed by the Department of Defense. and they still have this attitude that we're incapable, that we are inferior in some way to them.
Why don't they just let it go and let you guys manage your own, like a private, like everything else is? Why do they have
Well,
to have government-run health facilities and things for you? Where does that money come from? You're paying for it, or what is the deal?
Some of it's paid for and some of it isn't. A lot of us have insurance, that's taken at IHS, and then IHS is funded in part by the government. And like I said, so it's under the Department of Defense. And like I said, it was instituted in 1955, and it was supposed to be, it actually, even though it said it was supposed to be to encourage better health among Native Americans, we had fine health. And actually, what it was a, you could akin it to almost an ethnic cleansing, especially when it started, because they wanted to get rid of the Native American.
Well, the forced
Right.
sterilization was underneath that program.
Well, yeah, the forced sterilization was underneath that. And of course, people through history know that, in the 1800s, 1889, they vaccinated all these blankets with smallpox. They gave them out. We didn't have resistance. Massive amounts of Native Americans died, just from that.
So basically, when you hear in history that the Native Americans died from the diseases that we had that we came over and brought to you that you didn't have immunity to, that's not really true because they went out and gave you smallpox and other diseases on purpose.
Yes, what they actually did is they vaccinated the blankets with smallpox. Then they handed out the blankets, and when they handed out the blankets, of course we had no immunity, so we died.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay,
And
and that. Go ahead.
when they first came to the United States, there was over 10 million Native Americans, and by the time the 1900s got here, there was only 300,000.
Wow, so quite a bit. Now that is gets you to the word genocide. And one of the things that I have been told is that the United States has worked hard for that word not to be used. Can you tell me a little bit about that story and what they've done over time to make sure the United States is not pinned with the word genocide?
Well, our government's rather funny because they support the word genocide in other countries. And they support, genocidal museums, any type of activity that help restores goodwill between the people in those countries. Now, the U.S. specifically requested that the United Nations headquarters be moved to New York. And the reason they did that is because in the United States, the word genocide in conjunction with the Native American in the United Nations is forbidden to be used. And so, where it was in Geneva, you could go to Geneva and you could actually, as a Native American on an indigenous panel, use the word genocide. Now you can no longer use the word genocide in association with the United States. And that's always been a matter of debate among people, whether Native Americans, it was a genocide. But according to the United Nations itself, genocide means the act of committing with the intent to destroy a whole or in part of a nation, a country, a people. And we were the nation, we were the country, we were the people of this land. And so when the government came in, genocide is exactly what they did. They had policies in place that said specifically, our intent is to get rid of Native Americans.
And they
And
worded it that way, didn't they? There was actual wording.
they did actually word it that way. And in 2009, President Obama, and the Native American community didn't really look at it, as a wholehearted attempt. He issued an apology, but he did not open it up to the press. He kept the press completely out of it. So it actually never made the news, except for the few people that were able to get it out. And he signed an official apology, but there was nothing. It was half-hearted. It was more of an attempt to push it under the carpet then bring it out. You know, like for example, Germany. Germany has recognized the atrocities of that country and have tried to make right what is done. America just keeps burying it further.
Yeah, because at some point we need to, a lot of people, obviously a lot of people are aware of this and will state this. It's just the country itself won't admit to it.
No, it's the government itself, yeah. And that's where we get into the sovereignty issue, because sovereignty is really at the whim of the government. The government has disbanded federal tribes in the past, and so when you disband a federal tribe, you disband their sovereignty. So a lot of people think if you're a sovereign nation that you are a sovereign nation and you aren't beholding to anyone, correct? Well, that's not true. Sovereignty is it's a word, and it's a word that the government uses at its own discretion. If
So
they
they can just take it away.
Yeah, and they have in the past. And so there's a lot of Native Americans in the United States that are tribally affiliated but not officially enrolled, either because the government will not recognize them or the government has previously disbanded them as a federal tribe.
So what would be a reason for being disbanded?
Maybe you're a little too outspoken. Maybe you cause a little too much trouble. Maybe they don't feel they can manage you correctly. We never had a system of constitution, and I've been in on several tribal constitutions, and it's very hard to get a tribal constitution to work efficiently in an Indian tribe. And that's because that wasn't our structure, that wasn't our setup. And so the more we become like the American government, the more vulnerable we become to different situations that they create.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And they want to be able to utilize you for their purposes to a certain extent.
Oh yeah. And like I said, if there's a technology or something like that, or a vaccine, they come to the Native American population.
My understanding is that when there are social projects, initiatives, that they start with the Indians first to test it out. And part of that is the chipping, but has there been other ones as well?
The big one lately has been the chipping. And like I said, and people they weren't aware that it was tied into all of this other stuff. They flu vaccines, the CDC, IHS was one of the first to say all employees have to have vaccines. I personally am not a vaccine person, so I don't work at IHS currently. And so because they're under the Department of Defense, when new things come in, they're able to try it under the guise that it's going to benefit the community. It's going to benefit the native tribes.
And so they do that with a lot of vaccines. They test them out. Has there been a vaccine that they tested out, it didn't work well, and they pulled it off the market?
Not that I'm currently aware of, not, or at least not within my community here in Oklahoma.
So another thing that people seem to be unaware of is how they happen to manage children in families and boarding schools. There's this boarding school issue. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and that's another question. Well, there's two things. A lot of Native Americans, a lot of Americans don't know that Native children were forced into boarding schools, and they were hunted down by the military. And a lot of Native families would hide their children so that they wouldn't be taken. When they were found, they were put on trains and they were put in different parts of the country. Now, and their hair was cut. They were disciplined for speaking their language or anything to do with their culture. One of the ways of being disciplined is they would have jails in these boarding cells, and they would handcuff these children. They would put them in the jail, and they wouldn't receive food or water or proper clothing.
How old were they?
Masks, they would put them in as young as 3 years old, and they were raised up, and they were taught a skill. And my great 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 my grandmother was one of those. And when they were released, they were sent to specific families. And usually these were wealthy families. And the women were taught to be housekeepers, cookers, babysitters. And the men usually worked on farms or plantations. And they would have some sort of skill for these families. And when they went to the boarding school, because they were so removed, a lot of people don't understand that that's a key component for Native American traumatization. Because when you're separated from your parents, your especially your mother, during a certain time frame, and that time frame ends at age 5, you emotionally disassociate and you don't know how to be a parent. So a lot of these, when they would come back, they weren't really welcomed into their community because they had lost so much of their culture. And when they went on to try and be parents, they couldn't be parents. They did not know how. And so it has perpetuated a cycle that has exploded in the Native American community. And we've tried, we keep trying to get back our culture and the way that we do things, and we're a little more successful. But the last boarding school actually closed in 1989. And a lot of people don't realize that that's really fresh.
It is. So, were they still doing the same behaviors up through 89, or did it evolve a bit?
It didn't really evolve. I have some very close friends of mine that went to the boarding school here, where I live, which is now closed, and that's on Concho. And we have forests behind Concho, and there's story after story after story about children that have died and are buried out in the forest. And
Why were they,
there's
how'd they
mass
die?
They didn't take care of them. If they got sick, if they had something, they would just let them get sick and they would let them die. And there's all over the United States, you can find stories where, and these people, they're not old. We're talking 60, 65, and they remember these. They remember, a classmate suddenly would disappear. No one would talk about it. There's other boarding schools across the states that, they had, they would burn the bodies, and people remember this.
Well,
And some,
89 is not that long ago. I graduated from high
it's
school
not,
in 89.
yeah, and so it's not, and that's what I say, these people are not very old, and so they remember, this type of thing. And anywhere that you go in the Native community and you talk about boarding schools, you'll find someone that was in one. Someone that knows a child that died and was buried, didn't have a grave. They have a lot of mass graves, kind of similar to Canada. Canada had that same problem. And as a result, it's really traumatized the individual to be able to go on with their life because it was a separation from their parents at a young age. And the reason the government did that is because they knew that would break the bond. And when you break that bond, that child kind of splits, and they're never really truly able to form attachments. It's kind of the same thing with adoption. When you're taken at a really early age in your first few weeks and you're given to adoption, a lot of kids that are adopted have trouble with attachment because it's really important that they stay with their mother.
Or somebody that can be a mother figure, right? Somebody who loves them and takes care of them, right?
Well, no, actually, they've shown the studies have shown it really it has to be the biological mother. They've taken kids away as young as 3 weeks, placed them in families that really loved them, and they still ended up having attachment issues, not being able to sustain relationships, not being able to have a good barrier, when it comes to raising kids. And so it has to actually be the biological mother.
What
She
happens to the children
really.
whose biological mother is just a terrible person? The kid is hosed?
Well, I know a lot of that, and I know there's a lot of children out there that have issues, have problems because, you know, their mother and their father are not appropriate parents. That's why so many are in therapy today. That's why we have a younger population that is the way it is. You know,
Jeez.
because
Okay.
parents don't take responsibility for being parents. You know, they leave it up to everybody else.
That is true. We have an issue with that. So another issue that affected the American Indian, Native Americans were this was the slave trade. Can you share with us some of that?
Yeah, I would say probably at close to 99.9% of Americans do not realize that there was a slave trade going on with Native American Indians, and I wasn't even aware of it until probably about 15 years ago. And when I traveled to the Middle East, there's a lot of Native Americans in Turkey. Well, the reason for that is when the slave boats came over from Africa, obviously they had slaves. When they went back, people were under the assumption that they went back empty. Well, they didn't. They went back full of Native Americans, and specifically Native American men, because they were believed to be a dissident or somebody that would cause trouble or be a problem in some way. And so they would fill these slave boats with Native Americans and they would ship them over to the Middle East. And this is something that you never hardly ever hear talked about. And Americans don't know. You know, they think, well, the Native American didn't have it as bad as, you know, the black people or, you know, whatever. But we actually did. We weren't. My great grandmother used to say it was better to be black than to be Indian. And it was because the Indians were given their rights after the blacks. We weren't even considered human. It took a legislative act, and I believe it was 1934, to declare that Native Americans were actually human. And to just to think about that, I mean, imagine if that was you. You know, if that was your family and they were saying you weren't human, and what they would do is they would take the bones and the skulls, which is why we have the Repatriation Act, and that's to get back bodies that were held in the Smithsonian Museum because they were brought there for scientific study to determine if, in fact, we were human.
Oh, jeez. You know, one thing is that it says less about the Native Americans and it says more about the people that did that and the people that thought that, right? I mean, you have to realize that. In today's world, we know, well, it just shows that the people who didn't think they were human were idiots. And it makes you feel bad for the people who had to deal with that. But it really says something more about the people that came over and colonized the country or the land.
Because like we've all the saying, you know, kill the Indian, spare the man. That was a saying that has been around for a long time, and that was one that was used in the boarding schools, and that's why they felt if, you know, by separating the mother and the child, you know, they would be able to break that Indian culture. And in breaking that, they were somehow saving Native Americans.
Well, how were the men treated in the Middle East? Were they treated as poorly as the black people were here as slaves?
You know, actually, a lot of the Native Americans that I know that are in the Middle East now enjoy a pretty good life. But back then, you know, they were treated as slaves, and some of them actually ended up intermarrying into the different cultures there. Just like when we had slavery here, the tribes took in a lot of the runaway slaves. And so different tribes, you know, have a history, a black history, because we embraced that and took them in, you know, when they would try and get away. And so a lot of the Middle Eastern countries did the same thing. They eventually ended up doing the same thing.
Wow, so there's really a history that needs to be written yet for people to understand and understand what our true history is. You know, the truth is hard to hear and hard to embrace, and that's part of our problem is people don't want to know what the truth is. And it's much easier to just be ignorant, right? Ignorance really is bliss. You know, I don't even want to know that we're, but it's
That's
important that the
true.
truth, yeah. Well, will you stick around and answer another question for my patrons?
Sure.
Well, again, thank you so much for joining me today. I've learned so much, and maybe you can come back at another time and share some other interesting information with us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.